It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Mike Elgin joins Renee Ritchie and Andy Yannacco. We're going to have some great discussions, including the idea of the iPhone being a fingerprint reader, identity and more, whether Apple can actually read your encrypted data on your portable device or even File Vault, and we'll talk about what to expect at WWDC. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 350, recorded May 14th, 2013. Catnip for geeks. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by the new PDF Pen 6, the powerful all-purpose PDF editing tool from Smile. You can add signatures, make changes, correct typos, fill out forms, and more. And now, with version 6, you can export your PDFs to Microsoft Word format. Learn more at smilesoftware.com/MacBreak. And by GoToMeeting with HD Faces from Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with colleagues and clients anywhere. You could share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing, even from an iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code MacBreak. And by Shutterstock.com. With over 20 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors, and video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and use the offer code MacBreak5. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover all your Macintosh news. And we've got a great panel for you, as always, from the Chicago Sun-Times, the lovely and talented Andy Yannacco. In Center Square to Block. Hello, Andy.
Lovely and talented are both subjective terms, but I'm glad you decided to apply both. That was very kind of you, Leo.
Of course it's subjective. And I have good taste, just like Bill Gates said Steve Jobs had. We shall get to that. And is that... Okay, don't tell me. It's a rodent of some sort. It looks like it could be a squirrel, but it's the tail is wrong.
You're close. It is a member of the squirrel family. This is a groundhog.
Wow.
So this is testing out some long lenses the other day.
Punxsutawney Phil.
Yes. Active buggers. I was truly 33 years old before I discovered that woodchucks and groundhogs are actually the same thing.
Really? I'm learning that now, and I'm 56, so.
Exactly. I only found out there were squirrels, like two members of the squirrel family, two weeks ago.
Nature. There's never always something to learning. Surprise you.
they're always making up new stuff for you to have to learn. I mean, you leave high school, you think you're done. Stupid scientists.
Don't forget to visit the library, kids. They don't do that anymore. No kid goes to the library anymore, right? They got the internet now. Maybe if they need the internet.
Well, they need the internet for in-game purchases. And while That's they're it. There, maybe they'll learn something. About certain species in their backyard.
Also joining us from, oh boy, BlackBerry World.
BlackBerry Live.
Live. It's Renee Ritchie. And I'll explain this. Renee has not gone apostate on us. He is not suddenly switching to the other team. But iMore is a family of sites, including crackberry.com.
Yeah, I have two jobs. I run iMore, but I'm also the producer for Mobile Nation's video stuff, and we're doing a lot of video while we're at BlackBerry Live.
Ah, because you're such a good videographer.
No, because no one else wanted to do it.
Well, I want to get the news from BlackBerry. I'm very, very excited to hear that BlackBerry Messenger is finally on iOS.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been an interesting show so far, Leo.
That was irony, but that's okay.
No, I'm sorry.
Maybe sarcasm. I'm not sure about the two, but I'll ask Andy because he probably knows the difference. Also joining us, from his apartment somewhere in the world, Mr. Mike Elgin. Hello, Michael.
Hello. I'm actually in Silicon Valley.
Oh.
So I am somewhere in the world. That's
I was going to get you to give me a hint, like tell me what time it is.
It's 11:37.
In the morning. Wow, that's right. He must be in Australia. You're in Silicon Valley. What are you doing
I came
at
back
home?
For Google I.O.
Oh, you're here for Google I.O.
Yeah. And also, you know, spend a couple of months, see family and stuff. And we're going to take off again in August.
You are living the life, and I'm very jealous. For those who don't know, Mike decided that because he was an empty nester and no grandkids yet, that now's the time for Mike and his wife to see the world. And they lived for a while in Africa, in Spain, in Greece, on Sparta. Where are you going to go next? You know,
we're going to initially go back to Europe because we just didn't get enough. And probably France and Portugal and just sort of hit some of those. We originally were going to avoid Europe because it's very expensive.
Not Portugal.
We just can't draw ourselves away. We had such a great time in Spain. It's not even funny. And we just had a fantastic time. So we're probably going to do Europe again.
And the euro is a little weaker than it used to be. It's probably not a bad time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great time to be in Europe.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome. We are on the eve. Tomorrow is Google I.O., and then in about 3 weeks, we've got WWDC. It's that time of year. Apparently, developers work in the summer, I guess. But it's that time of year for the developers conference. I guess we could start a little bit with Google I.O. Well, wait a minute. Since we've got somebody at BlackBerry Live, we should really get the news from BlackBerry Live. I was being facetious about BBM. On iOS and Android. It's a little late. I mean, are people still using BBM?
Yeah, I mean, they put out a lot of statistics, and I think, you know, they have a huge engagement level, and people check their messages very quickly. They send billions of messages every day, and a lot of people, especially in emerging markets, they get phones that only have BBM plans, the same way they might get a phone like Facebook plan. And it is late. I mean, there's companies like WhatsApp and other companies that have gone into that space and become very popular. But BBM is still, for a large group of people, the way they communicate every day. So it's nice to see doing it for Android and iOS, no mention of Windows Phone. It's nice to see they're actually going cross-platform for once.
It's a little surprising. It's as if, I mean, they could have done this years ago. I guess they wanted to preserve their monopoly?
Yeah, well, actually, Torsten Hines, the CEO, addressed that on the stage, and he said that previously they were kind of risk-averse because they didn't have new hardware or a new operating system on the market, so they had to maintain whatever lock-in they could. But now with their new system, he said they're very confident about extending their services to other platforms.
By the way, I have to apologize because Renee is on Wi-Fi. We're going to get occasional breakup like that, but I think the sound quality is pretty good, so we'll stick with it. What else announced at BlackBerry World? Anything? I mean, BlackBerry Live. We already know about the Z10 and the Q10.
A new phone.
A new phone.
Yes, the Q5, which is a lower end emerging markets phone. It comes in a bunch of colors, like red and pink and black and white and yellow, I think. And it's very light. It reminds Christina Warren from Mashable said it's like a Centro for BlackBerry, and that's a very apt description. So it looks like a Q10, but decidedly lower end.
That's interesting. Everybody's making phones for the emerging market. In fact, we're just waiting to hear what Apple's going to do for emerging
And they also
markets.
Did BBM Channels, which is their version of Twitter, so you can now have someone subscribe to you in BBM, and they're creating it for brands and for celebrities, and you can follow different people and exchange with them the way you would on any other social network.
Yeah, because Twitter is such a flop. I think it's time, really, for somebody to move in and do it right. And who better, really, than BlackBerry?
Their infrastructure is like one of the last big things they have left, and I think it behooves them to exploit it as much as they can, you know, before it's way past too late.
Yeah, it's not a good sign when a company starts saying, do you know, we have a lot of high-end office furniture, we have ping pong tables, we still have a lot of equity here in the company.
All right, we shouldn't, I'm not going to make fun, well, I'm going to stop making fun anyway of BlackBerry, and I wish them well, because you know, I mean, I think this is probably true of many of us, that the last smartphone I used before the iPhone came out in 2007 was a BlackBerry Curve. That was the smartphone platform, that and Nokia's Symbian platform, until Apple came along. It was really, in some ways, what Apple was doing was in response to the difficulty using Windows Phone 6.5, BlackBerry, and Symbian.
I really don't know what Eric Schmidt from Google would do without his BlackBerry.
He still uses a BlackBerry.
He does.
Yep.
It's going to really frost
inexplicable.
The Android team's nuggets.
Yeah. I still see them all. You still see them all over the place. I mean, they're still, again, the fleet vehicle phones that lots of corporations issue to people.
Sure. Government still likes BlackBerry, although you see Samsung making a big deal about its secure platform and safe.
Although that didn't release. I think Knox got delayed again.
Yeah, it's been delayed and delayed and delayed. I think, though, you know, the Pentagon just approved Samsung phones and about to approve iPhones for use in the Pentagon. I think that that notion that only BlackBerry Secure is now,
yeah,
even that, it's too late.
Well, they kind of talk about three levels. Like, they have ActiveSync for the very basic, very easy stuff. Then they have something similar to what iOS and Android does for the middle-level stuff. And then they have the super high-level stuff. You can disable things and basically make the phone no fun at all right. to use. No camera, no apps, and for secure levels.
That's a great selling point.
Make your phone no fun at all. Well, they even have on BlackBerry 10, they have a dual mode where you have almost separate logins for personal and work.
BlackBerry Balance.
Yeah.
You can have the same phone, and you can actually partition it for both occasions.
Hmm. Isn't that crazy? But it makes sense.
Yeah.
For a lot of people, it makes sense. Have two separate phones. And that's what Samsung, in those ads, those famous ads with the unicorn apocalypse, we're talking about how in the accounting and sales department, there was one person who had two phones. And she said, well, I have one for home. That's my iPhone. And one for work. That's my BlackBerry.
I believe the unicorn apocalypse commercial, it was a Samsung commercial.
What did I say?
I think you said BlackBerry.
Oh, I meant Samsung for sure. Yeah. Yeah. So BlackBerry will remain a part of the Department of Defense's mobile strategy for the time being. But starting February next year, they're going to open a platform-agnostic mobile policy, which will allow Android and Apple devices, including iPads, I presume, in the door of that five-sided building.
And that was the other last big announcement here, is that all the BlackBerry management stuff and security stuff is going to work across platform too. So they're opening it up to businesses having all those devices, and they just want to be your tool to manage them all.
That's probably smart. That's acknowledging the way it is, right?
Yep. Yep.
Apple, I'm very pleased to say, is starting to roll out its two-step authentication platform worldwide now. I got to get mine turned on. There's something keeping me from doing it. I have to make a call.
I just got mine.
Yeah. How does it work?
I think currently it's only still limited to SMS. I just get an SMS message and I have to put that in, which is good because if you don't happen to have an iPhone, but you have an iPad, you can give it any SMS number you want. But I think after a while it's going to work over Apple ID as well, like Find My iPhone.
So,
It only kicks in whenever you want to make purchases or whenever you try to make purchases from a brand new phone or a brand new device. So it's not as though – I don't believe it's – I haven't turned it on myself yet, but it's not as though you'll have to key in a PIN every time that you want to make a purchase or buy an album. It's like every time it sees a change in your activity that might be correct for somebody who's trying to rip you off, it'll ask for a PIN number first.
That's good. So why – I'm surprised, though, you guys haven't turned them on yet. I have it turned on because I tried, and then there's something blocking me from doing it, and I can't.
Mine's on.
Yeah, you turned it on. Okay.
Yeah, I turned off Gmail and Dropbox authentication because they were asking me every time, and I kept getting invalid tokens,
right.
And it was so secure I couldn't get in. But so far with the Apple one, it's working okay. They don't ask very often.
I use it wherever I can, including Facebook. I do still use Google, and you're right. It's a little bit more of a pain, but not insurmountable, and it's certainly a lot more secure. Where else do I have two-step? I have two-step on a lot of things. LastPass, Outlook.com, Microsoft's added two-step verification. I wish Apple would support, as those do, by the way, the Google Authenticator. There is this, I didn't know this, but there's a standard for two-step identification. It's an open standard, and it eliminates this need for a text message. You could have an application running that would give you the authenticator code as well. I don't know if Apple's not using that technology, but it is a standard, and I love it. Microsoft's using it. LastPass uses it. Google uses it. It means we don't have to have multiple different ways. A text message is fine, but if you're out of the area or something, I guess you wouldn't be buying stuff.
It's fine as long as your text messaging is reliable. If you start getting them out of order and you send multiple ones and they invalidate the previous one,
right,
that you get later than the first one.
Yeah, I'm going to have to – I think I have to make a call to get mine working, so I guess I will.
Yeah, the question is if Apple users are the kind that will really put up with any sort of a two-step verification system that puts any friction between themselves and the goal that they want to get to.
So I think this is why Apple waited so long to do this sort of thing, and why the way that they did it was not the Google way, which is to keep asking for you to revalidate over and over again, but to try to be really careful about when it tries to enforce that.
You remember we talked about that article, that somewhat misleading article, that the feds couldn't wiretap iMessages. Apparently, Apple is deluged by police demands to decrypt iPhones, according to Declan McCullough writing in on CNET. Because the ATF said nobody could unlock a defendant's iPhone, Apple is being asked to do it. Apparently, Apple can, and they now have a police waiting list. So just a point.
In weeks.
If you think that passcode locking your iPhone is secure, it's not, because Apple can unlock it. Which means, I mean, if Apple can unlock it, go ahead.
Well, no, only that we still don't know exactly what means Apple can use to unlock this. It could be that they, the article is actually very clear about this, that you don't know whether there's a some sort of a backdoor that Apple knows about, but the consumers don't. I don't think that's it, because that would be incredibly problematic. We don't know whether they are just simply better at figuring out how to look at forensic clues inside the phone to figure out what that correct passcode is, or what the encryption how to decrypt it.
I don't know. Here's the affidavit from the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms in a Kentucky case, quote, Apple has the capabilities to bypass the security software and download the contents of the phone to an external memory device.
But is it, who wrote that? Was that someone with a technical know the difference between bypass and simply?
No, it's the law enforcement. I don't know how sophisticated.
If Apple types 0000 into your PIN code, it will unlock your phone. I don't think that's
Sal Segoyan's brother, who is a security guy, a principal technologist at the ACLU's Speech Privacy and Technology Products, says mobile users should take this as a warning. Google and Apple can provide access to data stored on an encrypted device, at least in some circumstances. The presumption being, it says disk encryption protected by a passkey, but apparently it's not secure. Now, Simpson Garfinkel, another very smart guy at MIT, actually he's an associate professor at the Naval Postgraduate School, said it's impossible for law enforcement to perform forensic examinations of devices seized from criminals. However, you can do a brute force attack on it. So maybe that's what Apple's doing. I don't know. Elcomsoft offers a brute force attack on four-digit and passcodes that they can crack in 20 to 40 minutes. If you've got physical access to the phone, you could do that. Four digits isn't that secure.
Yeah, and there's really great software for if you have file-based protection on all kinds of systems. Graphics cards have so many processors on them that there are brute force algorithms that just 5 years ago people thought that, well, for to brute force this six-digit password would take about 8 kajillion years, and now because of the software and the best and consumer hardware, you can get that down to weeks, if not days, which is still too much to try to brute force 10,000 passwords. But if you have one guy that you're trying to compromise, that's certainly reasonable.
10,000 is probably a closer number for the feds in terms of the number of phones they're trying to crack. I wonder about this, because why would the law enforcement, various law enforcement agencies wait for Apple? Why wouldn't, I mean, if it's brute force, the two questions. One is it really true that it's almost impossible for the feds to get into these things? And is it really true that Apple has a method for getting in? I'm going to go ahead and go with a working assumption that it's all true, because why would law enforcement wait for Apple, wait 7 weeks or something like that, when they're really champing at the bit to prosecute someone? And why would they go to Apple? I mean, Apple's not going to download some brute force software from somewhere. I think it's a reasonable possibility that they do have an actual method, a backdoor of some kind that allows them in. I don't think that's an unreasonable scenario.
Well, a security expert, this is way above my college education, but a different expert explained to me this way, that there it's like there's
I lost my car keys level encryption. I lost the password to my bank account encryption. And then there is a deranged madman with a backpack nuclear device somewhere in this country, and he intends to detonate within 30 days. Problem. So mm-hmm. there's nothing that can't be solved with big enough stakes. He even sort of laughed at when I cited a different report from about a year and a half ago about a certain encryption method that was just theoretically uncrackable. He said, no, if you put enough manpower, enough of a priority on it, it could be fixed. The problem is that when you have something as simple as a backdoor, or something as simple as if you open up this device and get access to the storage directly, I mean the actual physical hardware, you don't want a situation in which law enforcement could get access to this stuff on a hunch or as a shortcut. You really have to make it so that the reason why they're sending this phone to Apple or sending this phone to Google or trying to get access to privately held keys is because, yes, they feel as though it really is that important. They have the entire case. They now just need this another piece of evidence to collect this thing. You can't put them in a position where they think that this is like one of those red kiosks at the supermarket where you insert phone, wait 2 seconds and get data out, or else they're going to be going on fishing expeditions everywhere. But yeah, it can be done. The question is how involved is the holding corporation going to be?
So what you're saying is the local sheriff doesn't have access to NSA to crack down on some drug dealer or something like that.
Yes.
So he goes to Apple.
Exactly. But a lot of them, they're there's a lot of law enforcement tech conferences in which they do. There are companies that do sell kits that can and a very quick training program. So will basically allow almost any medium sized police force to deputize somebody as their official information officer. And so there's hardware tools and software tools that can largely automate the process of getting this data off. And this does count on the person with the phone not being so careful about keeping their data secure, but there are also keys that I haven't seen but have described to me where if a law enforcement person were to simply casually ask, hey, can I look at your phone for a second, they can take it back to their prowler. There's a device in their car. They can essentially get whatever data they can possibly find off of it and then return it to you, thinking that really how much damage could they have done with only 5 or 6 minutes, which is why the ACLU and other organizations are saying that, you know, treat your phone as though it is essentially every document, every piece of personal information you have. They can ask for it, but you don't necessarily have to hand it over. If they really do need it, then they can make an official legal demand for it. Until then, you keep that thing in your pocket.
So it makes me wonder what will change when Apple, and if Apple, but I think it's more of a when, builds fingerprint readers into their phone. And hopefully they won't do it in the idiotic way that a lot of Windows laptops have fingerprint reading, which is as a convenience. Yeah. Mostly people use it as an alternative to the password, giving hackers two ways to get in instead of one. Hopefully it'll be seriously locked and provide serious positive ID. But I imagine that would change things pretty dramatically if all iPhones had biometric authentication.
Hey, I do want to talk about that because you wrote a good article that the I in iPhone is going to be identity. So let me boil it, and then we'll do that in a second. Let me boil it down, though. There's really a simple question, which is Apple brute forcing this, and maybe they have better means to do so because they can dump the data off and they have ways to do that? Because, frankly, if it's brute forcing, I can't believe that the NSA or even a local sheriff's department does not have that technology. Or does Apple provide a backdoor? And if they do, then is there a backdoor in File Vault as well? And if there is, that's serious cause for concern. And I would point out that this is exactly why I always encourage people to use open source encryption technology and not closed source, because you can never know with closed source encryption if there's a backdoor, if the data is accessible to law enforcement.
Well, when this story got above the waterline recently, I tried to sort of update the information that I had the last time I did a deep dive into security and the law. And again, I'm not a cryptologist, nor am I a lawyer, but I couldn't find any information to update the understanding that if Apple were to or Google were to have an official backdoor key, that would cause so many problems for them trying to sell this as a secure device for businesses and for the government that it would be almost impossible for them to implement it.
A good reason for them to keep this quiet.
No, if they had that technology and they kept it quiet, that is serious. That's such bad hoodoo that they, I don't think that they would touch it. My understanding.
Not at all. Andy, that it might be bad hoodoo for business, but you know, the government wants Skype and other forms of conversation that are not wiretappable to offer backdoors. And the presumption is that Microsoft, as soon as it acquired Skype, in fact, did put a law enforcement backdoor into Skype. And they're not going to announce that. They're not going to tell the world that. In fact, they may not even be able to, thanks to the Patriot Act.
I mean, why would they even go to Apple in the first place if Apple isn't doing anything special? If they don't have anything unique that gives that's based on their manufacturer of the phone,
they have a backdoor.
What's their involvement at all? They have no involvement in it.
I will say that most of my trying to figure this thing out is what they're legally required to do versus what can they do on their own. And time and time again, we're finding out that agencies don't need to have the law on their side. All they have to do is have a polite and productive relationship with private companies that already have control of your data. However, that said, if they have a backdoor and from what a different consultant was telling me about a contract that manages tens of thousands of devices across very, very high secure, high transaction individuals, if they had a backdoor into whatever security that they're using, that would be almost a jail time sort of problem if that were actually discovered.
No, I think you're exactly the opposite. They're requiring it.
We have heard many times
that government wants the backdoor, and they're insisting that private companies put the backdoor in.
They're not, but they don't have that legal requirement yet.
Not yet, but there's no reason you can't be extra nice to law enforcement and do it ahead of time.
That's the difference. That's
not against the law.
That's the difference between they're required to have a backdoor and they have chosen to put in a backdoor.
Do you think that Skype doesn't have a backdoor?
I would not doubt that Skype has a backdoor.
So why isn't Microsoft more liable than Apple?
I'm saying that the scenario that you're saying that if they're making public statements about the security of their devices and using that to get contracts about how secure their technology is and how secure the data that people entrust and companies entrust for that data is, if unbeknownst to the person who makes that purchase or signs that purchase order with that company, that there is actually a way for a third party unbeknownst to them to get access to any data on that device, that essentially... I'm trying not to speculate because again this is way outside these legal areas are way outside my expertise, and the conversations I've had with people about this were broad in nature and not specific. But for them to have that backdoor, not disclose that they have the ability to at the request of law enforcement to access that device openly, not simply to try to circumvent stuff, but they have a walk through the back door. there's a screen. There's an unprotected thermal exhaust port protected by a trench on the far side of the battle station. That's something they would be required to disclose.
There's also, I mean, that's a U.S. specific thing, but Apple operates in many countries, and not all of them have the same legal systems as the U.S. And if that sort of system existed, we've heard stories about other platforms in other countries having
like
provided
BlackBerry.
Absolutely, and they spoke about that today, and they said that you know they have to follow the laws of the varied countries and jurisdictions and the legal processes, and if they're served a warrant and it's a valid warrant from a valid court system, they have to comply just like any company has to comply. So if you have that kind of backdoor, I mean, what's to stop a country that has very different laws and very different concerns for citizens' rights from using it in ways that it's not used in the U.S.? But we've also heard stories about people getting physical access to your iPhone and jailbreaking it, or security flaws that require physical access. And it's not hard to believe that, you know, when a company that makes a phone has physical access to that phone, that there's all sorts of things they can pull off even without a formal backdoor or entry system into it.
I guess the point would be, and Garfinkel points this out, if you have a 4-character passcode, that can be brute forced very quickly. If you make it longer, as you should, you can make it difficult to brute force. We don't know if it's brute force or if there is, in fact, a backdoor method. But it would be prudent, A, not to put anything really private on your iPhone, and B, have at least a 10-digit PIN, which Garfinkel says with current technology take about 25 years to brute force. Now, it's a pain in the butt to enter a 10-digit PIN every time you unlock your phone. So my suggestion is don't put anything on the phone you don't want somebody to see. Because it's not, I don't think it's private.
Yeah. On the phone or on the internet?
Well, the internet, we know. Well, yeah.
I just want to clarify that, like I said, sometimes it's hard to talk about things where you're getting information secondhand. My understanding, that at least in the United States, that if Apple or another or Google or another company, that they're not required to unlock a phone for a third for even for law enforcement. That's not like a legal requirement they have to follow. That's more of a voluntary thing. But yeah, I mean, there are phone numbers and there's data that I will not entrust to any digital device. And a lot of that reason why, personally, is because I like to have the answer to the question: is there any chance that this got that someone hacked your phone and got this? I can say no, because that has never been on my phone in any way, shape, or form. It's all about what's the worst case scenario of a certain piece of information falling into the wrong hands. And in many cases, for everybody, even if you're not, you know, cooking meth in your basement, there is going to be that data that you don't want to put anywhere.
I will also point out, because a number of people in the chat room are saying, oh, no, you don't have to worry because there's a remote erase. And if you can set it as if somebody tries to unlock it 10 times, it'll erase. I think you can presume that Apple has disabled both the remote erase and the 10-time penalty away as soon as it gets the phone from law enforcement.
I would like to say, for the benefit of the Apple engineer and vice president that is using this as an infinite microphone, because I've got it in the let's have a little self-control here, that there's the problem is that when you have a situation of the unknown, yes, it's true that anything can possibly happen. But then you sort of have to click that into that little Lego slot of what piece will fit into what. If we're talking about the idea that Apple and Microsoft have free and Google have free and unlimited access to all the data on your phone for any reason, that's not true. I don't think anybody should doubt that there are going to be circumstances under which the data on your phone could be compromised, triply so if you ever let this out of your possession, right, for more than 30 seconds.
Or if it's taken from you by law enforcement.
Or if it's taken from law enforcement, and that's why there are people who do have those a drill and a circular saw ready to go. That before, right, you know, they let something out of their hands, you always have the ability to destroy this phone. You're not required, unless things have gotten pretty far into the investigation, to preserve documentation and preserve evidence.
Yeah. Fortunately, I just don't want the
pull quote from this episode to be Apple has unlimited access to all your data and everything they're telling you about the security of the iPhone is a lie.
It's not from this episode. It's from Declan McCullough writing at CNET. ATF says no law enforcement could unlock a defendant's phone, but Apple can bypass the security software if it chooses. This is an affidavit from an ATF agent that says Apple has the capabilities to bypass the security software, download the contents of a phone to an external memory device. It's not made up. We're not speculating. This all comes from an affidavit by a federal law enforcement official to a court.
Exactly. We need better information, but so far that's...
Well, you're not going to get it from Apple or law enforcement. In fact, ATF said we can't comment.
But we're also going to get it from people who are as well-informed as that ATF agent and probably as almost as well-informed as anybody inside of Apple. I've been looking around. I'm not saying I doubt this statement. I'm saying that...
You think he's mistaken?
I'm saying that I would feel better about the statement if we saw some outside consultant say, yes, this tracks very nicely with what I know and what I've been told from other people I work with in this industry, and I haven't been able to find it yet. So I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just saying that this is now on the level of this is a piece of information that is out there as opposed to a part of the accepted and understood reality of life on planet Earth.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll hear more about it. I hope we hear more about it. The federal government in the U.S. at least seems to have unlimited ability to quash any investigation.
Hopefully there'll be a Freedom of Information Act.
Yeah, you know that won't work. FOIA is redacted.
You should definitely file that because the United States Postal Service can use the postage that you're going to be making to mail in that request.
Civic duty. Buy stamps.
Way to keep that Saturday delivery coming in.
I think there's a backdoor. And I think that's distressing, but I think you should assume it in every case. Unless you're using open source encryption.
I have heard that they don't have a lot of access to your stuff. Even people who work in those areas have no access to your stuff. So I have nothing definitive, but I've heard that, you know, they just can't go get your data.
Yeah, except we have this affidavit from a guy who, you know, in an active case, who says they do. Do you think he's wrong?
I don't know the process whereby some guy can just walk up to the phone, press a button, and get one. I mean, there's different. Well, I don't know exactly what it means.
No, he says only Apple can do it, and Apple can. He says,
but that's a different issue of whether anybody in the departments, the various departments of Apple that we can talk to, can get access. Of course, they can't. But whether Apple has a small group somewhere or some method where they specifically respond to requests from law enforcement is an unknown question at this point. But even if that were the case, it wouldn't be the case that just any random person in Apple would be able to access stuff. That's an entirely different issue. Right. I'm sure they would be much more responsible than that.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the point would be if anybody at Apple could do that, that you should presume that your data is not protected. That's all.
That's true in general.
I've got some data
that's very, very solidly encrypted, but even there, I don't pretend as though this would never ever come out. I mean, it's not information about where I've buried bodies. You know, for the record, I don't bury any bodies.
Well, when the quantum computers come, Andy, you're in a lot of trouble.
Well, and I got to say, if you're putting something really super private on a device that you carry around in your back pocket. You're a pretty trustworthy person as it is. Yeah,
I personally have no valuable information of any kind that I can think of, and anything that is private is kind of. I don't store it in a file on my phone. Right. I have it in the cloud, and I try to protect that. But what data are people carrying around on the phone? I think it's mostly about messaging, communication, and ultimately financial issues, and we have to worry about identity theft and all that kind of stuff as well. So.
Yeah, and really, what law enforcement wants from a phone is not a super encrypted file that listing all my crimes, but merely the phone numbers I call, where I've been,
location data,
all of which they can get very simply with a pen register. They don't even need the phone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's probably the case that this isn't that important. It's just something to be aware of.
Yeah, And it is interesting that this is the same discussion that we've been having ever since encryption started and ever since law enforcement very reasonably had their reaction to personal data encryption, which is that will there ever be a federal law passed that in so many words says that you do not have the right to store information in such a way that the government cannot read it if they want to.
Fortunately,
it's ever really going to end.
Fortunately, the courts have so far upheld our right to have that stuff private.
Absolutely. There have been times when law enforcement have tried to put in provisions into various internet related legislation and information related legislation that says that law enforcement shall have freedom of access to a certain data stream or a certain product, and that's never gone in.
Right.
As soon as that gets exposed to the light of day, it becomes such a politically dangerous thing to support that the thing dies.
Well, I'm more concerned about companies like Apple and ISPs voluntarily offering that as a feature just because they want to be nice to law enforcement. And that seems to be the case. Certainly ISPs, remember Carnivore, the FBI box that was preserved 18 months of your internet access, never did manage to make it into law, but ISPs quite happily installed it.
But that's uncomfortable also, because it turns Apple and Google into the Supreme Court deciding what's constitutional, what isn't constitutional. Right. And, it's a really difficult problem for that reason exactly. If the companies have the access and are deciding whether or not to grant access to specific requests, which in fact is the case right now, then these companies have enormous power over how information and privacy and law enforcement works that we don't necessarily want them to have.
I want to talk to you, Mike, in a second about your Google Plus article. I guess it was in Computer World on the iPhone and why the I and the I, next iPhone might mean identity. I think we've mentioned it on a number of shows because I think it's a fascinating thing.
Yes.
But now we get to talk to you and find out why you think this might even be.
I chimed in at the time and you couldn't hear me.
You talked back.
Yes.
Why I oughta?
What are you talking about?
Our show today brought to you by those great folks at Smile Software. We just love them. They're great supporters of the Macintosh community. They make great software. And there is a new version of PDF Pen out, PDF Pen 6 for the Macintosh. You can now export PDFs to Microsoft Word format. It's got a new editing bar, a great new design. I just love PDF Pen. I've used it for years. Anytime I have a PDF, and, my son's a freshman in college now, or going to be a freshman at CU in the fall. And, of course, that means what? A lot of forms to fill out. I said, Henry, here's PDF Pen. Here's the PDFs. Start filling them out. It's great. By the way, it looks great on a Retina display. They've optimized it for Retina. You can create a library of signatures, initials, and that's what we have. Henry's signature, we scan it in. His initials, we scan that in. You can fill out text fields. It even will automatically do a form fill-in for you, which is fabulous. I think you're going to like it. It is the PDF editing and annotating application and very affordable PDF Pen. You can get it in the App Store. Or I would suggest going to Smile Software and getting a demo version of it first. It's always nice when they offer demos. One thing the App Store will not do, but you can do at smilesoftware.com/MacBreak. smilesoftware.com/MacBreak. They also have it for the iPad. It's a wonderful, useful tool. I use, so often. It seems like this, and I'm actually thrilled. Faxes are kind of dying out finally, and people are sending PDFs. Often they say, print, because most people don't know what to do with it, print this out, fill it in, scan it, and email it. I skip all that print it out, fill it in, scan it stuff. I just use PDF pen, and I can do it all very quickly, very easily on the computer. Looks great and satisfies everybody. I can even export to Word, which is really nice. Try it today. PDF pen is available, the new version 6, for free trial at smilesoftware.com/MacBreak. Back we come to MacBreak Weekly with Mike Elgin, who's back at Silicon Valley for Google I/O, then back out into the wild, wild world around us. From BlackBerry World, it's iMore's Renee Ritchie. Where is BlackBerry World today?
It is in Orlando.
Beautiful Florida. And is
yes.
What is the kind of the spirit of people there? Are they a little bit like, or are they excited?
I think they're mostly defiant. You know, it's almost like when WebOS was on the ropes, you know, there's people who are just hardcore fans, and they see this as their second, maybe last chance.
Good. Also with us from the Chicago Sun-Times, Mr. Andy Inatko. And it's great to have all three of you. One of the things I love is that we can have these really good, informed discussions with you guys. Maybe not get to the bottom of this. We won't get to the bottom of it until Apple or somebody steps forward, but at least we can really talk about the ramifications and what it means, and I just love that. So thank you. iPhone. Now, the reason you said this, Mike, is because of the rumors that the next iPhone will have a fingerprint reader.
Well, Apple acquired the world's leading maker of fingerprint readers, and they have been kind of holding back on their digital wallet solution. It's sort of a hobby at this point, I would say. Simultaneously, the problem of identity is the single biggest problem. Now, this isn't a problem that users think a lot about or care a lot about, but this is the big problem in Silicon Valley. Eric Schmidt said that Google Plus was created not as a social network, but as an identity platform. O'Malley said that Facebook's whole purpose is to provide an identity. And this is why the social networks have required real names. They tried to require it. It doesn't really work. At some point, Facebook was even telling people they need to take pictures or scan their passports and driver's license. And they're desperate. Everybody's desperate to have their service be identity. In other words, an electronic entity that is essentially you with a photo ID and a signature, that kind of authentication. And once you have that identity service, this is a $1 trillion opportunity for whoever can nail it. And nobody can nail it because nobody can get people to give up their fingerprints or can get people to really do what's necessary to have real identification. So I think Apple is the one company can do this. This is Apple was the company. Their core competency is the ability to change user behavior. They got us all using touchscreens and online on-screen keyboards. Nobody else could do that. They did it. Once they did it, everybody did it. And so this is what Apple's really, really good at. They take this huge opportunity where the experience is awful for the user and where it's a big problem and where if that problem was solved, a whole bunch of other things would be awesome. So here's what I think they're going to do. I think they're going to combine fingerprint authentication on the phone with wireless technologies like Bluetooth 4.0 and especially NFC. And they're going to use that as an easy pass to almost every site on the internet. So imagine a phone with those components in it and a really well encrypted system where you scan your thumb right at that moment, and within the next few minutes you set it down next to your keyboard. There's another NFC chip in the keyboard, and that's you. That's you on the internet. That's you logging into the computer. You go to, it's like logging in your Apple ID. You go to Amazon or whatever, and you just buy stuff. You never enter a credit card. It knows your address, all that stuff, because it's positive ID that is you. And ultimately, I think it could be used as, you know, for security badges and all this other stuff. And Apple is the company that can do it, because if Apple builds, if Apple replaces the passcode on iPhones with a biometric ID, they're going to have dozens of millions or hundreds of millions of users using their biometric security within a pretty short period of time.
I mean, you know, it's clear that in terms of not merely, you know, social networks, but money, that identity is everything.
Everything.
I mentioned this before, that really credit card transactions, check transactions, any financial transaction, the fundamental problem that needs to be solved, and I didn't make this up, I was told this by a guy who's become a guru in this, is identify you, identify me. And once we can reasonably, seriously, effectively identify each other, then any kind of transaction is, you know, friction-free. It's the identification that's tough. But, Renee, is there any evidence at all? I mean, you're the iPhone rumor guy. Any evidence at all that this is going to happen? It's certainly not in the next iPhone.
No, the next iPhone, the last I heard, is still going to be an iPhone 5S type device, where it's the same body and the same general design, and that restricts the kind of new technology that can go into it. But Mike's absolutely right. They bought Authentic. And
not cheap either, $320-some million.
I mean, and Apple's very careful to say that they don't always make obvious use of the stuff they buy. They often pivot them in new directions or use the people there to do new things. But it is a problem that needs to be solved. Apple has this stuff. So if it's an iPhone 6 thing or an iPhone 7 thing, you know, hopefully not that long, it does stand to reason. I just haven't heard anything convincing of it yet.
I also wonder, because iPhones are not even half of the smartphone universe nowadays, if Apple has the market clout to do this. I know what you're saying, Mike, that Apple's the person to do this, but I wonder, I mean, maybe, yes, they were, but I don't know if they still are. Aren't they losing market share, isn't it, in the U.S., I mean, isn't it?
Every time they do a big thing, and the big things in the past 13 years have been the iPod, the iPhone, the iPad, you know, you might even say the MacBook Air or something like that. But whenever they do a gigantic thing like that, what they do and what they're really good at is creating markets.
Right.
Not inventing the technology, but creating the market. There were touch phones, there were touchscreen phones, multi-touch phones before the iPhone came out. And nobody cared. Nobody paid any attention. Apple did it. And from that point forward, every phone except BlackBerry's had touchscreens, and eventually a lot of BlackBerry's do too. So that's what they do. So as soon as Apple does this and standardizes it, then that will become a widespread behavior in Android phones and all these other phones. Apple's the company that's in a position to really start these kind of things.
One thing that also, to Mike's point, is that even with small things like IPS displays, most companies don't buy a lot of displays, but Apple was able to get them cheaply because they put them in every single iMac. And while there's not a huge market share for Macs, putting it across every single iMac is a huge order for the components. It's a huge standard. And it lets a lot of companies start making these things cheaper eventually. And if Apple were to put it in every iPhone, even though iPhones aren't a majority, it would be such a large segment of the phones that suddenly all had them that it does have the ability to shift markets and to create trends. I do think there's maybe issues with NFC security and maybe with getting authentication to work in a way that's easy enough for, you know, our parents, our siblings, our kids to use it. But the idea itself, I think, is something that Apple could really push forward.
I think it's more, I'll be honest, a little bit of a pipe dream, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to
see
it.
I just realized I'm muted.
Oh yeah, Andy's been talking this whole time and I haven't heard a word.
I'm sorry. No. I'm sorry. Just I needed to adjust. I needed to make an adjustment here. So I'm muted during the commercial.
Andy is uncharacteristically silent on this subject.
Why is everyone ignoring me?
No. No, it was more like me saying I don't know, and then you keep talking. Okay, that's fine. It's good to let us.
What do you think?
Talk. I think that Apple might have lost some of its chops in how to build something that every other piece of hardware can use, because they've gotten really good at building an operating system that works on the hardware that they build, that runs the software that they build, that connects to the service that they build. They're not quite, they might have lost touch with what is required to build a technology that can be deployed onto multiple platforms and multiple legacy devices.
Yeah,
so
I'm not saying
worried
that's what
about
they're
that.
Do. I'm not saying they're going to do that. I'm saying that they're going to start a. They're going to get the behavior. They're going to get the users. They're going to turn it into a thing. And then other people will do their own version of that. I'm not saying Apple's going to go cross-platform with this.
Well, it's when they bought Authentic, really, what I was thinking of was yes, payments like that, but also something as simple as iPad. Put a little dot on the back of it, and when I hand this to my son, the son picks it up. He touches the dot on it and becomes his iPad just as easily as logging out and logging in again. Same thing for multi-user computers. It's a really good way for one device to be shared among multiple people, and that's something that Apple could really control immediately. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to say that the iPads are never going to have the numbers of iPhones, and they're not going to have the mobility. Everybody always has their phone on them at all times, and there are hundreds of millions of iPhones. I think it makes incredible sense to put fingerprint reading on a phone, and almost no sense to put it on a tablet.
Except for Square, maybe. Like the POS, like point of sale, not piece of.
You put the reader on the iPad to make it a better.
Did you see that? Nice, by the way. You're going to see Square everywhere all of a sudden. It's the iPad stand that Square made announced today with a card reader in front of it. It's beautiful, and awesome. I just see cash register. If I were the national cash register company, I'd be worried. what do you need a cash register for anymore? The reason I bring this up is that's fully electronic. You need a cash register for cash, but we're moving rapidly to a cashless ecosystem, aren't we? And for that we need identification.
If we're looking 2 years out, maybe 3 years out, I definitely can see that happening. It's just that there's so much more. It's verifying your identity, and that's incredibly useful within the sphere of this one device. When you start to get trying to get other companies and other websites and other entities to trust that, Apple's going to have to be a lot more open about how they deploy it. They're going to have to make sure that it's absolutely damn foolproof. They're going to have to make sure that it also doesn't really compromise the design of the device. I'm sure they could figure that out. Yeah.
It only has to be more foolproof than passwords. How hard is that? The current situation is totally unacceptable.
It's pretty bad.
It doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be acceptable.
I think I'm going to have trouble articulating this in the next 38 minutes, but it's the great thing about passwords is that every website, there's no technology that locks that up. There's no requirement that someone has to license this to make that work on their own service or anything else. And if fingerprint identity becomes something that I can use on my iPhone to make it easier for me to access the stuff that's inside my own passbook, that'll work great. If it makes it easier for instead of having to type in an 8-digit PIN every time that I want to use the phone, I simply pick it up. That's a good win. That's a good use of that technology. But if it becomes sort of when I'm doing something that requires some sort of a password or some sort of a login, now instead of having login using Google, Twitter, Facebook, OpenID, and now there's a ninth logo saying your Apple fingerprint authentication. That's not necessarily an easier way to do that, considering that a lot of these services, I don't want this Tumblr blog that I'm posting a comment on to be connected to my Facebook. I don't want Facebook to be exposed to that information. I don't want that to be anywhere in the hands of this other company. So I'm just saying I think it's a more complicated problem that anybody who isn't developing this inside of Apple right now really understands.
Yeah.
So I think it's interesting.
You make a really good point. And the bigger point is that there's a larger world. It involves interaction with the larger world, not just happening on your phone. But I think that the first step into making that process happen and making the world accept this is for everybody to be carrying around this phone.
So I would love to see
is a meeting of the virtual five families that says that this is a big point of friction, that we need a way to solve this, and that we can simply all agree that here is going to be the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System for identity verification. And any way you want to, you can put a car onto this highway system, that's fine, so long as it is no wider than this, so long as the bridges can handle this sort of traffic, so that if Apple wants to use a fingerprint system that works 100% of the time, and Samsung wants to use an eye tracking mechanism that works 58% of the time but works during the on-stage demo, that's fine for them. I think it's going to be difficult when you have a system where Apple creates this wonderful standard, and now everybody else has to figure out whether they want to support it or whether that's the right horse or not. I mean, we talked about this when we were talking about Passbook. One of the brilliant things about the Passbook as it exists right now is that it's so easy for any point-of-sale terminal to support scanning a code. All you need is if you got a web camera of a sufficient resolution, you got it. It's done. It's locked. And then there's easy way. QR codes are easy enough to read. It's not something that you need to. It's not something that belongs to any one company or any one platform. It's a very easy pill to swallow. So it's I certainly can't imagine. When I say I can't imagine how that will play out in the next 2 years, that only means that I have to be humble at the foot of a great mountain that I still have yet to climb.
Yeah. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about big changes coming to AppleCare this fall. And is this a good thing or a bad thing? But first, a word from our friends at Citrix who do that great program we love so very much, GoToMeeting. I can't pretend I love meetings. it was kind of one of the banes of my existence at Tech TV. But I have to acknowledge there's something about getting all the parties together in one spot and saying, let's solve this now. Let's break through the clutter. Let's get the job done. And GoToMeeting makes these meetings as, I know they're necessary, makes them as painless as possible, makes them as effective as possible. And it's especially important if you work in an environment, and I think many of us do, where your clients or your colleagues are in other parts of the country or the world. You've got multiple offices. GoToMeeting solves so many problems because basically makes meetings more effective. You share the screen, so you are literally on the same page. But you also have this HD Faces technology, which makes this is if you spent thousands of dollars, actually in many cases hundreds of thousands of dollars on a video conferencing suite, you have my deepest sympathies because this is so great, works so much better, and it's one low flat monthly rate, and you can meet on anything on a desktop, on a laptop. It works on mobile devices. You can even present a meeting from your iPad. You can attend a meeting on your iPhone. You turn on that webcam on your iPad and suddenly they see you. You see them. You're seeing their screen. It is very effective. I know teams that keep GoToMeeting running all day. It's like working side by side, even if you're in different parts of the country. And the advantage of doing that is with GoToMeeting, one low monthly rate, flat fee, means you don't have to, pay by the hour or the minute. It's fantastic. Please, will you try it today? Visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and you can get 30 days free of this when you use our offer code MACBREAK. GoToMeeting.com, click the orange Try It Free button. You'll see a promo code link there. Click that and enter MACBREAK. 30 days free. The apps are free on the iPad and the iPhone. Put them on there. Get GoToMeeting on your desktop. It's so easy to start a meeting, attend a meeting. You're going to love it. It'll make meetings as much of the bane of my existence as they are. It makes them work. And then you get things done and you move on with your life. I love it. GoToMeeting. Give it a try today. And we thank our friends at Citrix, big supporters of the network and of Mac Break Weekly. We really appreciate that. And we appreciate it if you support them in return. Andy Iannocco from the Chicago Sun-Times. Renee Ritchie, he's at BlackBerry Live in Orlando, Florida. He, of course, is the editor-in-chief of iMore.com. And Mike Elgin, who's back at Silicon Valley. Are you getting excited about Google I.O., Mike, tomorrow?
Very, very excited. And right now I'm actually on an all-Google diet for the month of May.
I saw that. In fact, you wrote, and you Jeff Jarvis immediately brought it up, how great the Pixel is. That's your that's your notebook of choice these days.
Yes. Yeah, well, no, it isn't. It's what I'm using during the trial. So I'm still trying to reserve judgment on this, and I'm directly and deliberately contrasting it against using a MacBook or another Apple device. So I want to talk about what it's like to go for an Apple fanboy to go all Google, not only Google hardware, but Google software and Google services to the best to the degree that is possible.
If I had to, I wouldn't have any hair left. Tear my hair out. Kill me. Shoot me now.
I'm really excited about the possibility of Google Now in Chrome.
That is exciting. Now, you can try it now, right? Can't you? Because if the Chromium, which is the beta channel, has it.
Is that true?
Yes. Download Chromium.
Well, I have the Chromium is what's on the Pixel, right? So I should be able to do it on the
Pixel. No.
So I have to
Chromium download on OS X.
Oh, I see what you're saying. No, I think
isn't that weird?
Is in there, but I think the code is in there, but I don't think you can actually use it.
I saw the chromium cone hints at it, but I also saw, maybe I saw the wrong thing. Somebody said that it's now in chromium and you can try it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm mistaken on that.
Yeah, but in any
I can't event, wait. Google Now is an awesome feature.
In addition to being on an all Google diet for this month, a couple of days ago, I decided to go on to refine it and go on a Google Now diet. And I have a long list of things that I only allow myself to use Google Now for things like launching apps on an Android phone and all this stuff. So
that's weird.
Long story
short,
you
use Google Now to launch. Oh, you use the speech recognition.
Speech recognition. I'm using it. For everything you can use it for. It's like a lot of people do open up Google Now and wait for cards to come in. I'm trying to use it proactively, launching YouTube videos, playing music. You can just say play and name the song and it'll play it without touching the phone, stuff like that. And so the point is that I've been really familiarizing myself with Google Now, and I've become such a huge fan of Google Now. This is a fantastic thing. And when this hits the Apple sphere, forget about it. I mean, and I'm on the desktop. It's already on the iPhone in a limited fashion. But this is really, really a threat to Apple, I think, because once you really get hooked into Google Now, it's really a compelling thing.
You're right. I'm just checking that article. I misunderstood it. I was reading an article in the Next Web that said the Notification Center has been ported to Chromium Mac as kind of the beginning of what would be needed for a Google Now. It would have to be a notification.
I would be surprised if they don't announce it.
Tomorrow.
It's gonna be awesome.
It's a very interesting thing. Now I'm still using a Windows 8 laptop right now because I'm just waiting, because I know at the WWDC in June that Apple will announce Haswell based MacBooks. I'm hoping a Retina Air. I know that's a pipe dream, but even if it's not a Retina Air, I want Haswell based Airs, better battery life. So that's what I'm holding off on this.
If they ship a Retina Air, that's going to be my main machine.
That's what I mean. That's such a killer product.
Yeah.
Okay, get ready for this. What about, they won't do this. I know they won't do this. This is like having a fingerprint reader on an iPhone. It's just a pipe dream. What about a touchscreen Retina Air, like your Pixel?
Apple won't do that.
I know they won't, but what if?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
I touch my MacBook Pro all the time and nothing happens.
It's driving me crazy.
It'd be cool if that happened, if something happened when I touched it, other than embarrassment.
I think Apple could do this. Why not?
Because that's not how they roll, man.
Yeah. Also, OS X is not touch optimized in any way, shape, or form.
And now,
stop Microsoft.
They're just throwing spaghetti against the wall.
Windows 7, I mean.
I think that you could. I mean, I'm using touch on desktop apps on Windows 8 that aren't really optimized, but you could still, you could add a few hooks. It wouldn't be so hard. It's just a mouse, except it's not a mouse. It's your finger. I don't think
it's better than nothing. But that's not how Apple rolls. When they want you to use a computer in a certain way, that's the only way you can use that computer.
I know.
That's the difference between Apple and Windows and others. But I'm a really firm believer, and I don't think anybody believes in it more than I do, of the future of desktop computing is touch. I think that the iMac – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think that Apple is going to comfortably skip over touch and go more towards natural language and gesture, more like Kinect-based gestures. You don't have to physically – touch the screen, but you'll get the same effect of touch using a variety of other technologies.
I think it'll be all of the above. I think that the iMac of the future is a giant screen, 41 inches, set at a drafting table angle with voice commands and voice recognition with touch. You can put your keyboard on the top. It'll recognize stuff that you put on the surface. And this isn't anything we're going to see in the next 3 years, but I think it's almost inevitable that this is where it's going to go, that we're going to have that the future of the desktop is going to be a lot more like a giant iPad and a lot less like a, an Apple II.
And that's what killed Windows 8, ladies and gentlemen, right there.
I agree. I agree with you completely, Mike. I mean, I've said it before. As we get another generation, a whole generation of people whose first computing experience was to tap a screen, it's going to get more and more important as these people get into their teens or their early 20s that a desktop has to have touch control or else it's just going to look like a command line DOS-based interface. It's just not going
to
work.
We have to realize that the WIMP user interface, Windows icons, trash cans, all that stuff, is 35 years old.
Yeah, wow.
It's ancient.
But it works. You know, isn't it conceivable that something is just so good that it doesn't need to be changed? I know we live in a world where change is at a premium,
But I just feel like sometimes something's so good, why change it?
Okay, but what makes something good is that is rightness to the human mind and our what we are as human beings, as animals. That's what makes something good. The ability to reach out and touch something directly is something human beings have been doing since the beginning of time. Using this funky contraption that you move it over here and something changes over there, that is never going to be as good as touching something directly. And I think that's, and that for that reason, we're going to move toward touch because that's how the human brain works.
I mean, if you look at it, Apple didn't add WIMP interfaces to Apple II. They made the Mac, and you know, they didn't add multi-touch to the Mac. They made iOS, and they don't let you go back. They don't put arrow keys on, you know, the Apple on the Mac. They don't put the mouse pointer on multi-touch. And it's not hard to see that Apple, you know, probably wouldn't retrofit or try to graft multi-touch into OS X, but where they go in the next 2 years or the next 3 years will be that product that takes you to the next level, the same way the Mac did to the Apple II.
Yeah, and to the comment about, I mean, when I say, oh well, they got this so perfect the first time out that they never had to change it. That's how perfect the first iteration of this is. That's always like sarcasm. That's always meant to launch off. Yeah. I mean, true art.
WIMP is not the first. We're not in the first iteration of WIMP.
True art.
We're in the last one.
It's the situation we're in though now is that every new technology is a response to the times that it was crafted in, or at least the times the 3 years previously before all the engineering got worked out. And so the interface of the iPhone is from 2007. It reflects the reality that the engineers knew in 2007. The Windows mouse interface is a reflection of 1984, 1985, 1986. It's had refinements, but we haven't had that sort of real big aha moment on how to make this interface that works so great on a tablet, works so great on a phone, and translate that to make something that's relevant and makes great sense on a desktop too. So I don't think there's going to be a need to. I don't think that the users are demanding a revolution, but the next system that's going to really knock everybody on its butt is the company that can really fuse all of those interests today. We need our first Obama-age interface, and we don't really have that yet.
I respectfully not disagree, but I would change it a little bit. I think you're implying that interfaces are like design, that there's fashions and there's times, and you have the interface that's right for the time. I would think that it's more like an evolution. What we're trying to get to is the ultimate in a natural interface.
Yes.
We're trying to get to the point where the barrier between us and the computer is eliminated, and it does, you know, it kind of, that's why Google Now is cool, because it kind of knows ahead of time what we want to know. And I think interfaces are moving in that direction. Touch is better than mouse because it's more direct. Speech might be better than touch for some things because it's more natural. Aren't we moving towards more natural interactions? Isn't that what the end game?
That's part of it, but I think the more sophisticated look at this is that, remember how we used to use computers back in 1984 and even before then. It was sort of you had a whole section of the house that you had the computer and the monitor and your keyboard and the chair and the printer set up. It was sort of a grand thing that you made plans for. You even put on a special smoking jacket and fez. It was such a formal thing. And now a computer is something you dip into for 5 seconds, or you sit down for 3 hours, or you spend a weekend cranking out a problem, or you do something in line where you're waiting to get into Star Trek II this weekend. We need, and that is how people are interacting with their computers. That's how they learn how to do it. It's not always about a 3-hour project and sitting down and really focusing. Sometimes it really is about walking in and wanting to get that one piece of information before you walk back out again. And natural speech is one way to do that, but also touch is a way to do that. Yeah. I've said for years and years and years that one of my dream desktop computers is a screen that's always on. And even when it figures out that, okay, he's not in the room right now and he's not really paying attention. My camera says that there's no one looking at me right now. So I'm going to adjust the screen so that if someone does glance in my direction, I can give them information that will cause them to either recognize that they don't need to come and sit down at the computer or that they need to come here right away and find out what the situation is. So those are the sort of changes of interface that I think we're going to see. This is one of the reasons why I have such affection for the Microsoft Modern Interface, because it really is an articulation of that thing that years and years and years ago I really saw as something I personally would love to see. Again, a screen that gives you information even when you're not really dipping into the time suck of sitting at a computer.
The irony, too,
I just want Jarvis Microsoft like
is
Iron
that,
Man.
Is that Microsoft has this Pixel Sense product, which is just breathtakingly awesome, and they also acquired Perceptive Pixel, which was the leading maker of the the wall size computers. But here's the and I'm sorry, Renee, I know you have something good to say. I just wanted to get in one perspective for how to look at user interface. User interface design from the beginning of time has always been about the application of gains made through Moore's law to making the computer work harder to communicate with the user. In the beginning, you wrote code and the results came back in code. Then you punch cards and then you got the results. And it was like, and the human was working really, really hard to communicate, working really hard in this relationship. And then we got command line and then we got GUI. And the next phase is, the reason the next phase is going to be touch and voice and so on is that's how human beings operate. This idea that he talked about, Andy, about be able to, the ad hoc usage is the quick and dirty usage of computers. Well, that's how human beings interact with other human beings. We just chit chat with people. We say something, get an answer back. And that's what we are as humans. And as we go into the future, it'll work harder and harder and harder for us so that it behaves like another human, because we're hardwired to interact with other humans, not with machines. And so that's really, that's how you can predict where it's all going. The computer is going to work really hard to interact with us in the way that other human beings do.
I grant you, Andy, that there is some style in the sense that we use computers differently than we used to. So when you say the fez and the smoking jacket, while I do like to wear my fez and smoking jacket during the show, because...
The ascot, though.
See? It's at the cleaners.
You change with the time. There are times you wouldn't want to be seen on camera without an ascot on, Leo.
But it is true that a mobile device requires a completely different kind of interaction than a desktop device. So in that sense, it is trend-driven as well, because we're using devices differently. We're using computing differently. I do think, though, that ultimately it has to be the more fluid, the more natural the interaction. That's why I'm waiting. I don't want Google Glass. I want an optic nerve implant. Right.
Yeah. I was going to say, Leo, like, I just went to watch Iron Man 3, and the way he talks to Jarvis is my ideal of a computer. You talk to it, it makes holographs around you. You hold your arm out, your armor comes flying and wraps around your body. That's, we've been adding layers of computing. Like Mike said, you had the punch cards and you had the command line. On a Mac today, if you're a real Unix geek, you can launch up Terminal, or you can use the Aqua GUI, or you can use gestures on the new mouse, and we're adding these layers to it. Now there's dictation, and different people of different ages, Apple has been doing this. Not just Apple. People have been doing this inexorable march towards greater and greater accessibility. Punch cards were really hard for non-computer geeks to use. Terminals, really hard. Every time we add a layer to the interface, we're making them easier and more accessible. And it's not hard to imagine that the next big leap in interface is going to be to make them even more accessible to even more people, people for whom even multi-touch maybe is a challenge. And that includes voice, and that includes the computer looking at you and not just listening to you. And I think that's what makes companies like Apple so interesting, is that relentless drive to get to those more mainstream markets.
Another big change.
Go ahead. Used the iPad. Remember the first week you used an iPad?
Yeah.
And you could tell somebody, oh, it's great. It's far less power than your laptop, and it doesn't have a keyboard, and it's really great. And people kind of went, huh? But then you used it, and you're like, oh, I really get this. I really understand it. And part of that was the subtle psychology of physics and touch that you have to experience to really understand. And Google Now is like that. Using Google Now as heavily as I have in the last few days has really given me that same iPad experience, because I'm talking to this thing and it's doing things for me, and it's tapping into something very innately human, where you talk to people and they do things, or they respond and give you information and answer your questions. So it's really, voice is going to be a huge part of that, and that's a very, very natural interface, and it's just obviously going to get better and better with increased compute power and better software.
Yeah, we'll see. I like Google Now, and I think the good news is iOS people can now finally use it on if you have Google Search and you've updated it, you'll have Google Now. It's not the same as it is on Android, because you have to be running the application. On Android, it's just there.
And it's a bit of a battery drain on iOS still. They need to fix that.
Yeah. But I think what's really interesting to me is that people on the surface might think Now is creepy, right? Because what Google's doing is watching your email, watching all your searches, and then watching where you are, watching what you're doing, and then coming up with cards on Google Now that reflect what it thinks you're going to do next. Oh, yeah. I see you're at the store. You probably want to know how long it's going to take to get home, and shows you the commute and the traffic.
I think it's a good education. It's a good education, because it's harvesting that information already.
Yeah, it feels like on the surface it might be creepy, and yet when universally when people use it, they don't go creepy. They go, "This is great."
Yeah. I mean, it can be creepy, but all that has to happen it's a little bit like when an actor that you could never imagine in a role. It gets cast in a role about a movie that you're really looking forward to. Like, okay, Baz Luhrmann directing The Great Gatsby.
Exactly.
But if the first experience with that is positive, you forget all about that. Right. When Google, the first time that you open up a Google Now screen, you take an Android phone out of your pocket because, oh, that's right. Where was that restaurant that I'm headed to? I remember I Googled it. I did a search for it back at home 3 hours ago. And you take your phone out of your pocket intending for you to just do another search for it. And, oh, it's right there because it remembers my search history. And oh, look, here's a map on how to get there from here. All right, then. I guess I was very correct in giving my personal assistant information about what I planned to do today.
Yeah, it's smart. It's actually smart of Google.
But you trust your kids to people, all right? And you're worried about like, oh, my location. Google knows the address I searched for? Yeah. Come on.
Yeah, come on. Yeah. I never trusted my kids to people, but that's another story entirely.
There you go.
Hey, did you see Gatsby?
I saw the trailer.
I know, I'm terrified.
I'm not going to judge it because I haven't seen it. But here is my mindset. I truly want to reread the book from start to finish again
first.
Right before I see it.
Yes.
Not because I'm going to be comparing, but because I don't want, if it's actually been like about 8 months since I've read it, and I don't want like any of those visuals to get replaced by, you know, a Def Leppard song.
No, it's worse. It's Jay-Z.
Jay-Z. Oh, God. Yeah.
Nothing says the jazz age like hip hop.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm gonna go with an open mind. But you're right. You probably should reread The Great Gatsby. You should definitely read Ender's Game. Somebody just tweeted me because I had said, don't go see the movie until you've read the novel. Because one of, or the other is going to be a spoiler. Let Orson Scott Card's immortal sci-fi novel be the spoiler. Don't let the movie spoil a great novel.
Yeah. Words of wisdom.
And somebody tweeted me, I just listened to Ender's Game, just finished it on Audible. You are so right. So just a word of warning.
As I say, Baz Luhrmann hired a lot of people. A lot of people worked and were able to feed their families because for that reason, I'm glad that that movie got made.
Yeah,
but it's a full employment project. it was sort of a WPA administration, very timely for the time of the novel. I will say that if you can like go on YouTube and look up Bill Nack, NACK, and Great Gatsby, he's a legendary sports writer and absolute book lover, and he loves that book so much that he didn't memorize the last scenes of the book. He just happens to be able to recite it from memory. And there's a video of he's also a really, really good longtime friend of Roger Ebert. So there's a video of him shot by Roger Ebert reciting the end of The Great Gatsby. And if Baz Luhrmann could do something as 10% as good as Bill Nack reciting the ending of The Great Gatsby, then he will have achieved something very, very good.
That's really the thing about The Great Gatsby is that, you know, it's when you make a movie, it's about the story. It's about the ideas, the characters and all that kind of stuff. And it has an intriguing story and good characters and all that stuff. But what makes The Great Gatsby so great is the language. For people who are word nerds and language buffs, there literally probably isn't a better written book in the American history of American literature. It's a truly fantastic book.
You get a third of the way through it, and by movie standards, certainly by Baz Luhrmann movie standards, nothing has happened yet.
Yeah,
it's all about tone and scene setting and just the language and how you get there. And it's like, I'm not sure that you can do this in 5 second jump cuts. HBO or someone had Baz Luhrmann's William Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet on, and I'd never seen it before, and I'd seen like a bit of it from later on, and I happened to catch it like right before it was going to start. So I'm like, okay, great. I haven't seen this before. I'll start from the beginning, and I, honest to God, 6 minutes in, I had to turn it off because it was just doing things to my neurochemistry that I did not approve of. Nothing good. It was just. It's just, you're just shouting all of your dialogue and you put these unnecessary explosions in and, oh dear. Again,
I don't think there are any explosions in Shakespeare's Romeo.
Hired a lot of actors, hired a lot of lighting guys, sound engineers.
Yeah.
Again, I'm glad they all got paid.
I'm going to go see Gatsby. I want to see it. But I'm going to separate it in my mind from the book. And by the way, this is the only podcast in the entire Twit Network where I could say the words Great Gatsby and we get a 15-minute conversation about literary merits of The Great Gatsby. And I like it. I like it.
Break Weekly.
Next week, J.J. Abrams' Beowulf. We'll talk about it. Big changes coming to AppleCare. The town hall on Thursday. Apple, according to Apple Insider, informed tech staff that starting this fall, warranty subscriptions on AppleCare. This is a real bummer. The biggest announcement, according to an Apple employee who is not identified. Was the way repairs for iPhones will be handled. The way it is now, if almost anything's wrong with an iPhone, iPod, or iPad, and you go in and you've got AppleCare, we give you a brand new one. Or a like-new remanufactured device. Now we're starting to actually repair the products and return the same device to the customer. That's not so bad. You know, I routinely bring in my iPhone when the screen breaks. Not mine, my kids. When the screen breaks and you know, get a new glass piece put on it, not by Apple, but by a company, you know, a guy in the town who does that. So that's not necessarily bad. AppleCare will become a subscription model, or maybe they're going to introduce a new subscription tier. It'll be tied to you, not your products. Now, this is kind of interesting, especially for those of us who buy a lot of Apple stuff.
It's the first part, Leo. That's not entirely new. I mean, that's more a function of the iPhone 5 design. The iPhone 3 and 3GS were like that. It was very easy to take them apart and change components. Because of the way the 4 and the 4S were made, it was really hard.
Right.
But I think we reported right when the iPhone 5 was introduced that part of the, because of the way that it was put together, it was going to make in-store repairs easy again. And it was just a matter of getting the equipment into the individual stores. And now that's what's happened.
That's interesting. So you wouldn't look at the iPhone 5 and think, gee, this looks easier than the 4S to repair, but it is.
It depends which parts are glued to which other parts, right, and what parts are removed when you take the device apart.
Right. I'm very intrigued by this new AppleCare. The new AppleCare may include, and this is again all kind of, you know, a little sketch because it's not exactly rumors; it's leaks from a town hall. Apple Insider says the new AppleCare may also include exclusive 24/7 support. Pricing unknown. Under the proposed system, a customer is entitled to in-store training like that one-to-one program, which I think is fabulous. When you buy a new Mac, you can go in before the store opens, 9 in the morning, and get one-to-one training from a genius. What do your sources tell you on this, Renee? Is this all accurate?
I don't know. I've heard that they're doing a lot of changes to Apple retail, but I haven't heard anything specific about this. And also until they... I mean, things like this are programs that are being proposed and they can be rolled out or not rolled out.
Right.
Then is it wrong or would the plans just change?
Right. Lots more tutorials. They're going to have a home advisor team. Currently, I didn't know this. There are over 4,200 technical advisors who work from their homes. And they're going to, and that number doubled in the last year and it's going to increase again. And the idea is you've got people there at home. They're trained. You call them. You don't call them in their house, but when you call Apple, you get them.
They're at home in India.
Yeah. Well, maybe. Yeah.
I mean, that's the beauty of it is you can
be anywhere.
The best people, not just the best people who are in
exactly.
town.
Exactly. Instead of a universal swap out fee, you know, it's like if your iPhone, it's $200. I think it's $200 for an iPhone swap out if you have AppleCare. Now they can fix it per device. They have deployed advanced in-store repair tools and parts at select locations. So they're already doing that.
I get a little queasy when I read about innovation that involves saving money.
Yeah,
because I want Apple to continue its general assault on the universe and not start retreating into cost savings. I don't think that's what this is about really, but what's really exciting about this is that if I know Apple, what they're going to do is changes like this will reflect changes in how they design their products.
Right.
So if they have this policy where geniuses are always going to be fixing iPhones, I think they're going to probably have to make iPhones easier to fix or quicker to fix or something like that.
Right.
So this could be a harbinger of good things. Is that possible? Harbinger is a negative thing. But this could suggest design changes in the future that would make
harbingers could Apple. Be positive. Aren't red robins the harbinger of spring?
I don't know. We'll have to
cars.
This week in language.
It'll be a plague of success.
Yes, yes. Now that's negative.
In any event, I'd like to see that happen with their laptops and the MacBook Air to make those more repairable in the future, because this gluing everything together.
Yeah, they've been going the opposite way. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the iMac is basically the MacBook Air of desktop computers at this point. I don't know if that's changing anytime soon.
Yeah.
You might want to watch at CBS News some unaired footage with Bill Gates talking about his last visit with Steve Jobs. It's on the webpage, but they didn't put it on the 60 Minutes interview with Charlie Rose. When asked what the pair talked about during their final meeting at the Jobs home May 2011, Gates welled up saying, "What we'd learned, families, anything." He said, "Steve and I practically grew up together." It's true. And he said, "We were watching each other constantly with interest, not necessarily publicly, but I was always paying attention to what he was doing. He was always paying attention. He was not being melancholy like, oh, I've been gypped," said Bill Gates. "It was very forward looking like, oh, we really haven't improved education with technology yet. What do you think?" I think that's typical of Steve, not thinking, gosh, you know, my life took a terrible turn, but really thinking about the future.
One of the most emotional moments of that comment by Gates is that he said that Steve Jobs showed him his boat.
Yeah.
And talked about how great it's going to be to be out on the boat, even though they both know that wasn't going to happen.
Never did.
Yeah.
But the eternal optimist, Steve, I bet you Steve believed he was going to lick the cancer even to the very end.
Mm-hmm.
By single act of will.
Yeah, by will.
Yeah.
Willpower alone. I should refer people to Renee's iMore article. Time for touchscreens, Max? Hell no!
That's Peter Cohen.
Wrote that. Oh, you hired Peter, that's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's salty. That's a salty Peter Cohenism, isn't it? Hell no!
Yeah, absolutely.
I love Peter.
Why we got him.
I think we can move on, shall we? Our picks of the week coming up in just a little bit. Mike Elgin is here. Renee Ritchie, Andy Anatko. Our show brought to you today by Shutterstock. With over 20 million high-quality stock photos, illustrations, vectors. And it's just a fun place to visit. Go to Shutterstock.com, or better yet, if you have an iPad, get their Webby Award-winning iPad app. Oh, is that slick. Really fun. It's just like browsing this beautiful image gallery. Their sophisticated search tool lets you search and drill down not just by subject, but asset type, even gender, emotion. There's red apples. There's a color picker. The spectrum tool lets you say, "I only want to see green apples." Or if you've got a color palette you want to work with, that makes it much easier. I think a lot of creative teams get their inspiration and ideas this way. And this is all free to browse. Do make an account, though, because then you can create a Lightbox and save images to the Lightbox gallery, which you can also share with your coworkers and team members. Shutterstock is completely global. I love this, too. More than a dozen countries, Germany, China, Italy, Brazil, Belgium, multilingual customer support, dedicated corporate reps, and full-time support throughout the week in each of those countries. That is awesome, too. Look at some of these beautiful stuff. Now, we got a special deal for you. You can sign up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start using Shutterstock and saving images to the Lightbox. But when you find, hey, I got to get this giant ocean wave breaking in Hawaii. Oh, look at that. You say, I want that. Use our offer code MacBreak and the number 5, and you'll get 30% off packages. Now, they have image packages. They also have subscriptions. That's what I have. I have the 25 image a day subscription. Great for bloggers, publications, and so forth. Very affordable, and you're going to take 30% off that package when you use our offer code MacBreak and the number 5 for the month of May. 30% off. That is a deal. Thank you, Shutterstock. Thank you, Shutterstock. I love you, man. Shutterstock.com. Let's get your pick of the week, Mr. Andy Anatko.
Let's see if this window is going to actually move. My actual pick of the week kind of crashed on me on the most egregious way possible this morning, and forcing me to scramble to find another pick of the week.
Oh.
So I'm going to, I didn't know whether it was my fault or whether it was just really, really badly written software. It could, again, my ability to discover new ways to make something break is justly famous throughout this galaxy. So I'm not going to blame the piece of software just yet. So instead, I'm going to recommend something that I've been using for years. I think I picked this before, it would have been 2.5-3 years ago. It's from Photomatics. It's from a company called HDR Soft. It's called Photomatics Essentials. It's an HDR program. It's really the only one that I've ever encountered that I really, really like. A lot of people are familiar with what HDR is about. It's where you take there are some photos that are almost impossible to get. Like this was at the Boston Public Library where I wanted to get. Yeah, I wish you could see the whole thing.
I like the reflection though of the window in the lens.
Exactly, beautiful. And impossible to get because like you're getting all this light from the window. You can either expose for the window or you can expose for the clock. But that's really you have to choose one or the other. HDR lets you essentially take a series of exposures from light to dark, and then the software will combine them all together to give you a very, very high range of tones inside the same thing. There are a bunch of different apps that let you do that. Even the iPhone has an HDR mode, but usually, especially on the desktop, they'll give you a really fakey looking, just special effects, like a CGI, like the bad CGI 1997 version of what you saw there in the room. Whereas Photomatics, it will give you when you just drag the selection of images onto the app. It will line them up to make sure that they all line up with each other, so you'll get no blurry edges. And then it will give you start off by giving you like here are 9 different ways I can combine these together into one exposure. So if you want the sort of video game fakey looking version, it'll give you that. But if you want something that looks like a natural photo, as though you really did come in there with a big like $8,000 worth of lights, so that you could light the inside properly to match the outside lighting, it will let you do that too. So that's why I like it. It lets you give you that sort of like natural effect. And I use it all the time. Even if you don't actually buy this software, it's such a great idea to know how your bracketing feature works on the camera. We just hold on the button, the exposure button, and we'll just continue to click off frames at different exposures. Because even if you don't have the software, if you have it a week later, a year later, 2 years later, you'll have the stock that you need in order to combine those into a good, really nicely toned image. And Photomatics, they have a $99 version of it that's sort of that gives you really every bell and whistle you can possibly want. But for the basic function of I just want to be able to take these frames and merge them into a beautiful looking photo, they also have Photomatics Essentials that goes for just $40, works with just about any photo app you have out there. So like I said, a bit impromptu pick, but certainly worthy of another mention because, again, so many times when I really do wish that I had $20,000 I could spend on photographic equipment. I really do wish that, you know, when I'm going to Boston just for like a lunch meeting, that I could just bring my entire huge, you know, hockey bag style bag full of equipment with me. But no, instead, I will have just my phone with me, or I will just have my pocket Panasonic camera with me. And if I know that if I can't get the shot that I want with one frame, if I just take a bracketed series of exposures, Photomatics, and turn it to something very, very close to what I want, if not exactly what I want.
I love it. I use it too. It works well with Photoshop and Lightroom, and that's part of my workflow. Trey Ratcliffe introduced me to Photomatics, and I agree. Yeah. It's just spectacular.
It's addictive, isn't it?
It is.
It's almost like panorama software, where it's like we start walking into space and thinking, ooh, I bet this would make a good panorama stitch.
You know what I like is the way you use it. Because a lot of times you see HDR, you know it's HDR. You're looking at it. It's go, yeah. It looks like a painting. But what you did is you made what you saw in that picture work with the limited dynamic range of a real camera. So you could see the reflection in the window at the same time, and it's just beautiful. And you would never look at that and say, "Oh, that's got." Well, maybe a pro might. Oh, that's got to be an HDR. That's gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, I like to use it because the reason why HDR is necessary is that the human eye has a much wider dynamic range than an image sensor on even an expensive camera, and so HDR can be used to really duplicate what you're actually seeing in that room, because you're in there, you take that snapshot, you're disappointed because, oh, the windows, there's no detail in the windows. So you change the exposure, like, okay, and I can see through the window, but, oh, now the foreground is too dark. It just lets you get what you really came to get.
I agree. Beautiful stuff. Thank you, Andy Anako. Photomatics. Let's get a Mike Elgin pick here.
All right. Well, I've been on this Google diet, and I've discovered that there are some aspects of using Google products on iOS that are better than on Android. And one of them is checking in and doing things around location. On the Android platform, it's all lumped into the Maps application. Everything is in there. And it's kind of an annoying way to do it. On iOS, you have a separate Latitude app. And so I recommend using the Latitude app for check-ins. And it also recommended using Google Plus because it does some Latitude and Google Plus work really nicely together. So if you can go to my profile on Google Plus, Leo, on the screen, I'll show you a really neat trick that happens here. So first of all, unlike Foursquare and stuff, the default mode for check-ins on Latitude to Google Plus is that it doesn't spam your circle. So people who are following me on Google Plus don't get my check-ins. They actually would have to go to my profile to see my check-in. And that's the right way to do it. It's kind of passively there. It doesn't.
So I've circled you, but I didn't see this check-in at Jovi exactly. Coffee and Tea until that's I actually right. went to your profile.
That's exactly right. And that's
I like that.
Feature. That's wonderful. I want to check in. And for people who really care, I also have Latitude set up so that my immediate family is notified. And so they can see where I am. Exactly.
Yeah, if you look at my Google Plus stream, when I look at it, it's all check-ins all the time.
Right, it's really.
But I don't know if I've made those. That. I don't know if I've made those public or not.
Yeah. So if you hover over, it should hopefully this will work. If you hover over the location, in my profile, see the big picture at the top of my profile.
Yeah.
It's a big photosphere. If you hover over currently in Campbell, California.
Oh yeah.
The whole thing changed to a map.
Oh, look at that! Oh, so, that is sweet.
It's a really nice. Feature that hardly anybody knows about, but this is really great when I'm traveling. I'm in a really awesome location that I like to brag about. This it will show up as a map.
Yeah, in this case, it's probably not worth bragging about.
Campbell, California is nice, but
he's right next door to the Dollar Tree. Though you might want to get him to pick up some on the way.
Home of the Fighting Cougars.
Yeah,
exactly. So that's my recommendation.
That is
sweet. If you like to do check-ins without spamming people. It's a particularly good experience with Latitude on iOS. It's just a standalone app that you download. It's free, of course. And you can set it up so that it gives you the benefits of check-ins without all the irritants.
Google Maps on Android, of course, has it built into Maps.
Yeah.
And then did you have to do something to make it public? Because right now my check-ins, I didn't want to spam people, right?
Right, right.
So I made my check-ins private. So you make them public.
Yeah, you go in on the settings and you can do a default and then you can change it for individual.
Or I can say which things. Circles. It's like family circle.
Exactly. On the iOS app, though, that whole process is much better and clearer and easier. So I really like the standalone app approach rather than it's buried in the Maps app somewhere approach.
Right. Yeah. And how does it? So I never understood on iOS. Do you have to periodically launch the app or is it just kind of always running in the background? How does it do that?
You know, I think if you close the app, there's just nothing going on at all, and that you have to specifically check in. And so your check-in is sort of registered on the system for a while, and then it forgets and you vanish. So, for example, this transformation of my profile picture to a map, that'll just sort of, actually check in, after a while, that'll just go away.
Well, I have it, for instance, I have it set up to automatically check in at certain places like here.
Yeah.
I just sent you a sharing request for I only do it with friends because I don't want everybody to know where my house is.
Right, exactly.
But Robert Scoble does.
Yeah.
Maybe that was a mistake. I actually was eating at a restaurant at Petaluma once and Scoble shows up. And I said, oh, what a coincidence. He says, no, I tracked you.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. Fortunately, he was wearing clothes.
Google Glass told me you were having a bagel.
I like that. I think that's nice. And I love this new feature. So I'm going to, but right now it's only available to people, to like a half a dozen people. Do they have to be Latitude users or can you share it to a circle?
Which feature are you talking about?
This ability to highlight, to hover over my profile and see where I am.
Oh, no, that's for everybody. Everybody can do that.
Okay.
That works for everybody. The most interesting implementation of that, and Google did a special behind-the-scenes project, is the Canadian astronaut who's in the space station.
He's actually now home, Chris Hadfield.
Yeah, he's now home.
Yeah.
But his map would reflect the location of the space station when you hovered over it.
He is awesome. The coolest human alive.
Absolutely. Great singer, too.
That Space Oddity, we played it Sunday on Twit. Unbelievable.
Yep.
A lot of talent.
Oh, no, but wouldn't you think that there'd be some sort of like error checking code that says, okay, this guy says that he's gone around the world five times in one day. Clearly, GPS is screwing up on his phone.
He probably has a friend at Google.
he's literally 2 miles from the GPS satellite. This can't be right.
He could do that with NFC. Just he taps his phone on the satellite.
Right. It's an awfully strong signal. Oh, my God. He's in the house. All right. Very nice. Very nice. Thank you, Mike Elgin. I agree. Let's play with latitude. Let's let everybody know exactly where we are. Renee Ritchie is in Orlando, Florida. You got a pick for us, Renee?
I do. It's the story of a man, his beard, and his new application. For a while now, I've been...
Wait a minute. When you say a man and a beard, Jim Dalrymple leaps to mind.
Absolutely. I mean, Jim Dalrymple, he used to work at Macworld. He currently runs Loop Insight, the Loop. And for a while now, I've been complaining that he doesn't do enough long-form stuff because he mostly does curated link list content. So every time I spoke to him, I would complain, and he would just tell me to shut up. But the last time I complained, he said, just wait a little bit. And then I got the beta for an application, and it launched late last week, and it's the Loop Magazine.
Yeah.
So what this is it's very similar to Marco Arment's magazine. And Jim, you know, he didn't rip it off. He did talk to Marco about it before he launched it. But it is basically the long form content from the Loop that I have been wanting and I've been waiting for. And Jim does the introduction. Peter Cohen does an article on gaming. Matt Gemmell does an article on interface. And I like that, you know, publishing is made very easy now on iOS. Newsstand does a terrific job. And we get the opportunity to have all these great writers do these longer, more in-depth, sometimes more thoughtful pieces. And we get all these additional voices because the Loop magazine has a very different flavor to it than Marco Arment's magazine. And I'm sure more of these will spring up both from established publishers and people who just want to be entrepreneurs and publish something that they like. You know, Jim very famously likes Apple stuff. He likes web stuff and he likes guitars. Peter likes gaming. And it's going to be a very unique blend of a periodical, and this kind of stuff I find highly interesting, and I found the first issue of the Loop to be a really great read.
Very cool. How much is it?
It's $1.99. It's the same formula as the magazine, so basically the first issue is, I think, free for 7 days, and you can subscribe for $1.99 a month, and that gives you 2 issues.
I'm going to make a recommendation that I made before, but I'm going to make it in spades now, because they've just updated the Philips Hue lighting. This morning I got up and I got a update for my base, and it is getting more and more intriguing. This is LED lighting, not cheap. The base station plus your first three bulbs, $199 list, and then $60 list per additional bulb. But remember, these are LED bulbs. They'll last forever, basically. They also sip at energy. So I think in the long run, it's probably a push. But what you can do with Hue... In the past, you've been able to use your iPhone or Android phone to control the lights, to even take pictures and take the hues. Like, I'm in Greece and I want the light. It was so amazing in Greece. Actually take a picture and make the lights, because they're RGB, actually that color. They have reading. They have relaxation. They have concentration settings. Now, they'll recognize that you're home. Talk about location, Mike. Geofencing. Your lights will automatically turn on or change settings as you arrive home.
I love that.
Hue says it's like a happy puppy welcoming you at the front door, only without the slobber. Plus, as you walk out the front door, guess what? The lights turn themselves off. You got to love that. There is recurring alarms, so you can have Hue slowly ramp up every morning at 7 a.m. First, it's sunrise. Then it's bright noonday sun. Then if you don't get out of bed, it's afternoon and sunset and plaque. There's a timer. But the best part is it now works with If This Then That in a very more elaborate way. You can, for instance, and this is so cool, if it's raining outside, your lights can change to a blue rain color. Your favorite sports team starts a game, the lights will blink. Your stock price plummets, your lights will turn red, then green when it goes back up. You can randomly change your light's color with a text message. They can have
the John Hancock tip.
Yeah, I did years ago. There was a globe. Remember this globe that would change color?
Orb.
Now the lights in your house. I love Hue. I highly recommend it. They just updated it today. If you've got Hue, update it. I know it's pricey. It's $199 to get started. Best money I ever spent. I have it in my my rumpus room, my relaxation room, you know, where I watch TV. I have a TV setting that turns out the lights that reflect on the TV, but turns the other ones dim and low. I mean, it is such a great technology.
I have them everywhere now, Lee. I put them all through my entire place.
Have you played with Audium yet?
I have. Audium is fantastic. And I almost picked this, but I didn't have a chance to try it yet. And I don't like picking things I didn't try, but I was salivating this morning when it came out.
I downloaded the update. It's cool, man.
When I watch Star Wars, I make my room look like Tatooine. I mean, yeah. There's no better thing than that.
I'm just waiting for it to know what movie you're watching and then changing the ambient color to match the movie.
It has to be coming. I want to watch The Abyss in blue. Like, you know, The Abyss in blue, Dune in white, yellow. It would be fantastic.
Sometimes, you know, companies come out with great ideas but never follow through. I'm very pleased that Philips is following through with Hue and adding more capabilities. There's an API, so I expect more applications to come. I think this could be something, beginning of something really big. Hue 1.1.
A lot of my friends and a lot of my colleagues made fun of me for getting Hue. And then the moment they saw it, they all went out and bought it immediately.
Oh,
it is like geek catnip.
It's geek catnip. So is Renee Ritchie and iMore magazine. You got to go to iMore.com and read about it. Crackberry. What are the other titles you have to have there?
Android Central, Crackberry.com, Windows Phone Central, which is WP Central, and iMore.
Well, now that I have a new Windows phone, I probably should log into Windows Phone Central.
Absolutely. You'll love it. They're a great community.
Something wrong with me. I'm using Windows 8 and a Windows phone. I don't know. They're getting to me. Thank
it's
you,
all
Renee.
About developers.
To me, you know what? It's my job. I do it so you don't have to. Think of it that way.
I had that here, Leo, because people are like, why are you at BlackBerry? You're an iPhone guy. I just love technology. I want new things and new ideas. This is the best place in the world to get them.
We have never been a fan podcast where we try to be a little bit journalistic, and I think we do. I think we give you responsible points of view. We might happen to like Apple a lot. Mr. Mike Elgin, who's living in the Google world these days and in Cupertino at the same time. Mike, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
While you're in town, how much longer are you going to, before you headed back out onto the road?
Probably the rest of the summer.
Okay. Let's make a note of that, Chad Johnson, our producer, and get Mike up here as often as possible. We love having you in studio. Thank you, Mike.
Love to.
Also, thrilled to have Andy Iannotko here. He is smart, he's funny, and he's got great sideburns.
One out of three for sure.
And he has his very own gopher. Or no, groundhog.
Groundhog. There you go.
Nutria. Whatever the hell that thing is. Great to have you. Thanks, Andy. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We do Mac Break Weekly, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time. Each and every Tuesday, that's 1800 UTC on twit.tv. You can watch live. And you see the sausage being made right here. We just grind up that pork. Grind it up. But if you can't watch live, we do make on-demand audio and video available after the fact, and you can always download that at twit.tv/MBW for Mac Break a Weekly. Or, best yet, and I'd appreciate if you do this, get your podcast client and subscribe so that you get it each and every week automagically on your iPad, your iPhone, your laptop, your desktop. Thanks for watching. Now get back to work. Break time is over.